Chapter 13, December 18th, Midnight. A Family Affair. Wiley stood by the quiet waters of the Saunders, trying to get the courage up to try and cross into the other world. If Trevor could come here, then surely he could go in the other direction, and that was urgently necessary, obviously. He paced. He looked for some sign of the gateway. Martin was out there right now in those deadly woods, and somebody had to save the guy, and Wiley thought it might as well be him. He could bring Martin across. If nobody over there wanted him, he could live here. Impractical though he was, professorial in a way that Wiley found infuriating, nevertheless, the guy didn't deserve this to happen. His own son doing that to him. Good God. Why would they save him, then just discard him? And how could Trevor, too gentle to hunt birds for the love of Pete, ever be that hard on his dad? Over there it was storming. Over here the sky was clear. The moon, near the half, rode high. It was close on to midnight, and from the house he could hear Brooke singing. She'd once had vocal ambitions, but life and children and a certain lack of volume had kept her away from an operatic career. Her voice was too delicate for the stage, but on a quiet night like this one, it was an angelic wonder. He knew that she was sitting in a window looking at the moon, waiting for her man to return. She never protested his midnight walks, but they made her uneasy. It was as if her voice was meant as a kind of lifeline, reaching out to him in case he strayed too far from home. She sang an old lullaby, one that she had sung to Nick and still sang to Kelsey, a song from her deep past, his woman of the tribe of the Celts. It was called Dareen Day, the little song, and it floated across the softly muttering water like a breeze. He tossed a stone into the moonlight, listened to it splash in the deeper river. Where was the gateway now? Did it open and close? According to some of the more outré stuff he'd been reading about 2012, there were gateways all over the world, especially at the points where what were called ley lines met. He was not sure what these lines were. Planet energy lines would probably be the simplest definition. New Age bullshit lines was another contender. He stood just where he and Nick had been and tossed another stone. It gleamed in the moonlight, then splashed gently down. Damn! He heard something, though. He listened. It was on the other side of the river. He'd never heard anything quite like it before. He listened again. What was that? Then he knew, and his blood all but froze in his veins. That slashing noise could only be an outrider, and it was actually in the gateway, hanging between the worlds. He hadn't brought a gun. He'd been afraid that shooting it in the other universe would bring on some sort of catastrophe. He'd read all he could about parallel worlds, but little was actually known, except that experiments showed that they were actual physical places. There was no scientific speculation about what might be in them. He thought that he was the only person who had ever speculated that certain animals must be able to cross this divide, that they had evolved the ability as a threat avoidance mechanism. Had to be true. He'd seen a weercat himself, and not far from here when he was a kid. Damn big, damn black, and damn scary. Then gone, poof, right before his eyes. The slashing sound grew louder, came toward him. Brooke stopped singing. Her voice floated across the night. Wiley? Jesus. He needed to get back to the house. He needed to get his hands on a gun. Nick had been right to get them ready. That was a smart kid there. He had foresight. The slashing was now right in front of him, but he couldn't see it. It was loud. It was deafening. And then he could feel tickling. Then pricking against his face, his neck. Crying out, he lurched back. He fell against what felt like iron bars. Where he touched them, they became visible, and he saw that they were not bars, but the legs of what the kids called an outrider. And now the slashing sound was overhead. He was under the damn thing. He rolled. The slashing came down toward him. He lashed out at it, kicking furiously toward the sound. Where his foot struck, he saw a section of the creature, a gleaming abdomen striped yellow, then a complicated eye, then a hooked claw on the joint of a leg. Screaming now, he rolled. There was a pneumatic, liquid hissing, and boiling yellow sludge sprayed the ground around him. A stinger, the size of his arm, slashed his jacket and was gone. But it was coming back. He could hear the mechanical slashing of the jaws, but more, he could feel the thing probing with its legs, and he knew that the next time it attacked, that stinger would impale him. A roar, huge, echoing off into the woods. Silence. Nothing there. Nothing at all. Dad? Nick! His son scrambled down the hill that dropped to the riverbank. He carried his 10-gauge. He wore pajama bottoms and one house shoe. Behind him came Brooke.
Wiley! Nick! What's happening?
The moon sailed in splendor. The night birds called. The sacred peace of the Kansas night enclosed them, and the sweet little river rolled on. Nick threw his arms around his father as Brooke came running up, seeking with her hands, almost hitting him, enraged with fear, then choking back sobs, then holding both of her men. "An outrider," Nick said.
"I heard it, and I saw it attacking Dad, sort of."
Brooke nodded.
"Martin's in trouble," Wiley said.
"We know,"
Brooke responded. "We just read it, Dad. I was trying to get to him to cross over." Faintly from the house, they all heard Kelsey's voice call out,
"Is anybody home?"
"We're coming, baby,"
Wiley called. And they all trooped back to the house, where she waited at the kitchen door, her hands on her hips. She hugged her brother.
"Thank you for saving our daddy."
Then she went into her mother's arms. Wiley was not too surprised at what his family knew. Kelsey was 8 and an excellent reader. She was probably reading the book in everybody else's downtime. Brooke put on water for coffee.
"I think we need to tell Matt," she said. "We need some support out here."
"Fighting them is acknowledging them, believing in them, and the more we do that, the stronger the link to their reality becomes, so getting a posse out here might not be such a good idea." Brooke poured water into the coffee maker.
"Then we need to not try to use that gateway at all."
"She's right, Dad," Nick said.
"But Martin, he's dying out there, right now." Nick gave him a long, searching look.
"What?"
"Dad, just let it happen. You're fighting, and we can't fight. We have to just write, and hope they find it, and hope that it helps them. If one of us takes so much as a single step into that world..."
Kelsey's eyes were wide, and Nick dropped it. Brooke poured 3 mugs of coffee and sat down. Kelsey came into her lap.
"Nick, should you, this late?"
Nick gave him another of those searching looks.
"You don't remember?"
"He doesn't,"
Kelsey said.
"He can't."
"Remember what? What am I missing?"
So softly that it was almost inaudible, Nick said, "I'm the guardian. Mom is the facilitator. You're the scribe."
He glanced toward Kelsey, whose eyes were heavy.
"She's the sentinel."
He raised his eyebrows.
"Remember?"
It didn't make a bit of sense, any of it. Nick stared into his coffee.
"Our sentinel woke me up when she heard the outrider. If she hadn't,
You'd be dead now. He owed them his life. The bond that he felt with his family at this moment was the strongest thing he had ever known, the biggest emotion he had ever had. "Thank you," he said. Then he heard from upstairs, low voices. Kelsey had closed her eyes now, and Brooke began singing Doreen Day again, her own voice as soft as a breeze, too soft to drown out the conversation Wiley was hearing. He looked toward the dark stairs, then toward Nick, who jumped up and ran upstairs. "Nick!" Wiley followed. Brooke only glanced at them, then continued singing. Nick stood in front of Wiley's office, his shotgun ported in his arms. Wiley had known that there wouldn't be anybody there. He went into the office. The voices were louder here, more distinct. But nothing was breaking through. Not here, not this far from a gateway. "It's my story," he said to Nick. "My story's calling me." Chapter 14, December 18th, late. The Monster. Wiley saw reptilians, gorgeous, like snakes are gorgeous, their scales shimmering in a bright room with white tile walls, fluorescent tubes lining the ceiling, a metal autopsy table. Where was it? Then he knew, and he wrote, "The entrance to their lair is in Cheyenne Mountain, but the place itself is right here, right beneath us. It has to do with the mass of the planet and the power coursing through its veins, which are the ley lines and the great confluence of lines in this place. 12 miles from this house lay the geographical center of the continental United States. In the other human world, their base was beneath it, and in this world, if there was anywhere that they could break through, it would be in this area, where the veil between universes was thinnest." Wiley's hands flew. He hardly noticed that Nick and Brooke stood behind him, with Kelsey asleep in her mother's arms. The little team rode thus deep into the night, on the tide of Wiley's words. He watched his own hands, then watched the screen as the words appeared. "General Sampson injected himself, sucked air through his teeth as the familiar agony spread up his arm, then burned through his chest, then invaded his face and head, his whole body. It was a hateful, miserable thing to have to do every day. Today he did not expect to expose himself to the human Earth's atmosphere, but he was doing it under an order that he could quote precisely. 'You will maintain a physical state that allows you free movement in existing planetary conditions at all times.' There was nothing about not being prepared for a day because he didn't expect to be in their raw damn air. 'Time!' he barked as he entered the abattoir. His feet squished in blood. The place stank of raw human meat. 01044, Captain Maisel replied. Lying before them on a steel table was a body. Sampson looked down at it dispassionately. General Al North, big deal. He'd despised the eager creature with its idealism and its pathetically uninformed mind. He looked at the mouth, noted the drying along the raw line where the lips had been removed, and the clotted blood in both eye sockets.
"Maisel!"
"Yes, sir," he gestured.
"If you fail..."
"We won't fail."
"It's you, Captain. You! You will fail or you won't."
"Don't threaten me, General." She came from a powerful family. He didn't like it, but he must not forget it.
"I'm doing nothing of the kind."
"You'd like to, though. Anyway, I've already told my father what a complete piece of shit you are." He tried not to take her threat to heart. Her father could order death to a man in Samson's position.
Captain, I'm sorry if you don't like my style.
Your style? You have all the charm of a Skyrix, and you smell a lot worse.
It's the anti-allergens, as I'm sure you are aware. Please be reminded that my responsibilities leave me no choice.
He gestured toward General North's ravaged body.
If we're going to get this thing through that gateway, we have no time, so let's get started, Captain, if you don't mind.
You'd be delighted if I failed, General, of course, but I'm not going to fail.
This whole operation is in danger of failing, and if it does, not even your father will be able to save you. We still don't have enough slaves, and we can't get the personnel in to control the ones we do have, because the lenses are old and barely functional. We're losing 20,000 humans a minute, and we need another billion in 4 days.
Well, that's not my issue, General. My issue is this little rider sitting in the other human Earth, you know, the one you people haven't been able to enter usefully for the past 50 goddamn years. She strode over and slapped the chest of the inert human. If we don't succeed in this, we will both stand before Echidna herself, you and me, General Samson, and not all the power of Abaddon will save us. She crossed the room, moving toward a male who stood in silence, waiting. Doctor, she said to him, it's time for you to do your duty, assuming that you can. The doctor gleamed in the light, his scales tiny and creamy. She didn't know his name, but his appearance confirmed his class. She would be polite to him. He'd no doubt paid a lot for this job in hope of sharing in the spoils of Earth. However, the doctor didn't do anything. Let's get moving, okay? Samson chuckled.
The loyal retainer. Your personnel are as promising as your plans.
I need more power, the doctor said. 40,000 volts at least.
Do it with 20.
Captain, you do it.
All you have to do is use care instead of brute force to cover your incompetence, so do it with 20 or you're going on punishment report. I'm sick of your excuses.
Captain, for this to last...
We don't need it to last, we need it to work for a few hours. The doctor threw a look of desperation toward General Samson, who did not react. Okay, Captain Maisel said into her phone. How much can you give him? She looked at the doctor. Compromise. You can get your 40, but only for 1 minute.
I applied for 2, Captain.
Do it! Now! The doctor drew a narrow silver case from his pocket, opened it, and took out an instrument with a black, tapering handle and a long blade so thin that it was no more than a shimmer in the air.
This specimen has mild arterial damage from cholesterol, he said, typically associated with advance of age in this species.
Do we want to invest this species? Jennifer snarled. Where do you get off? It's the only other intelligent species we've found across a billion parallel universes and throughout our own. She gestured toward the remains of Al North. This creature, if it can successfully do what it's being designed to do, could save us all.
I hardly think.
Because, Doctor, have you heard the news from home? Have you heard what's happening there?
It's an aged specimen, Samson broke in.
I don't want you two sniping at each other, not when we're working against time and there's so much at stake. We are behind schedule. So move.
I won't be responsible if I'm rushed.
Doctor, I'll hand you over to the Soltex.
The doctor's scales shuddered and flushed yellow. Everybody feared the Soltex and their skills to capture the soul and to destroy the soul.
Under what regulation? You have no right.
Maybe and maybe not, but I will do it. Of that you can be sure.
You ought to do it anyway, Maisel added.
Shut up, bitch,
Samson said, his voice deceptively mild. How dare you?
Gonna tell on me again? Daddy's getting old. Daddy's not who he used to be. So maybe Daddy loses his power soon, and I get to kill your fucking little prune of a soul.
Talk about a hollow threat.
Are you willing to take the risk?
All you do is talk, but the clock doesn't stop, does it, General? You're easily distracted. You're failure-prone, Daddy says. She curtsied.
This thing of yours probably won't even work.
A mix of biological material from both Earths? It's bound to.
Well, great. Because if it doesn't, we can all kiss our asses goodbye. We fail here and we die here, in this facility, 1,500 cubits beneath gorgeous Kansas.
The doctor began to set out his instruments. Get support services in here, he said, if you want this done.
I'll be your support services. This is extremely classified.
Nothing like a military idiot for a nurse assistant, the doctor muttered.
Maybe I'm better than you think. Maybe I've even been trained.
I bought my job, and your daddy sure as hell bought yours. If I'm lucky, I might be able to flush a child's craw. Very lucky. Jennifer opened the small box she had brought in with her, in which there was red liquid.
Look at it, Doctor. This is living material from the One Moon Earth.
You're kidding.
There are humans crossing between the two worlds, Samson said miserably.
That's ridiculous, the doctor replied.
We believe it was a lucky accident, but that might not be the case. The Union's hand might be in the matter somewhere.
Maisel, suddenly interested, strode up to him.
You didn't tell me this.
You didn't need to know, he replied.
This casts everything in a very different light.
In what sense? The doctor asked. He had a stake in the matter, too. They all did.
If we're defeated by enemy action, Echidna might not be so, well, so hard.
Harder, never doubt it, Samson said. I've had experience in the palace.
I grew up with her last crop of children, Maisel said. My egg was honored with a place in her basket.
I've seen them running eggs through that exalted basket, a new clutch every 10 seconds.
Maisel turned on her hireling doctor.
Get to it, she shouted at him. Get to it now.
He lifted the lid of the black lacquer box, looked at the blood-covered material within.
Won't this explode if it touches this air?
It's not going to happen.
He drew out a long, wet object, a lip.
This is dead.
So is the cadaver, but we've got its soul.
General Samson thought of the millions of them collected deep under this room. The harvest of bodies had a certain value when terraforming began, but the harvest of souls was truly valuable plunder. It wasn't the doctor's business, though, or the captain's. For Samson, it was a guarantee of wealth beyond imagination, the kind of wealth that bought an endless supply of perfectly cloned bodies, and with them the sort of eternal life that only the highest nobility enjoyed. The doctor unrolled his instruments, taking a fleam in his long, narrow fingers, and drawing it along the line of one of General North's eye sockets, removing the dried flesh from the edges of the wound. Then, using instruments like two golden chopsticks with splayed ends, he drew out a bloody ball.
This eye is not in acceptable condition.
Acceptable for what, Doctor?
Maisel asked.
For use.
It won't see?
Oh, it'll see for a while, somewhat, but look at it. Look how it's deteriorating. Why is that?
General Samson asked.
General, I know you go topside because I prepare your allergy kit. Think, if you entered their world without your serums, you'd disintegrate, and this eye is disintegrating.
But if we get it back to its home world, then the rot will stop, won't it?
Maisel asked.
This is all ridiculous. This can't work, she persisted.
Can you attach it to the cadaver?
Sure. Then do it now, goddamn you!
He began using his instrument to touch the left eye socket, gingerly, experimentally. As the doctor touched the socket just with the tip of his probe, his fingers working with a pianist's virtuosity, immense generators that drew their energy directly from the planet's core started up deep beneath the facility. Tiny sparks appeared around the eye until the whole rim of the socket was shimmering as if with millions of little stars, each one of which was actually an enormously complicated object in itself, a whole miniature universe consisting of billions upon billions of stars, no bigger than dust motes on a gnat's toe.
"Is the tissue going to explode?" Samson asked.
"No," Jennifer said.
"I can't be sure," the doctor responded. "We'll have to see."
"We'll have to see? We could all be killed,"
Samson shouted, backing away from the table where the operation was taking place.
"Good,"
the doctor said. He then rested the instrument in its case and took the eyeball between the gloved fingers of his left hand.
"How dare you say that?" Samson hissed.
"Look, I'm here because I have to be. This whole thing, taking this planet like this, it's wrong. These creatures don't deserve this kind of treatment because of the avarice of a bunch of developers, and to be drafted by the military to do the work of a greedy few, it's sick and it's evil, General, and I don't give a rat's ass who knows what I think."
He inserted the eyeball, which settled into the socket with a sucking plunk.
"Well, what do you know? It didn't explode. Too bad. We live on."
"I ought to have you disensouled," Samson muttered.
"Ah, the hollow threat again. You two are certainly expert at tossing those around. Problem is, you can't do without a doctor. Therefore, I'm not in any danger, am I?"
He inserted the second eyeball, then attached the lips. The doctor stared for some time at a photograph.
"Hurry!
The lips are too fat."
"Thin them, then!" Samson glared at Maisel. "Time?"
0:10:48.
Still staring at a photograph of Al North, the doctor pressed a glittering cloth against the lips, the contours of which gradually grew more and more to resemble those of the general. He then addressed his attention to the genitals and rectum, which were taken out of the box and attached to the body. In the end, it appeared fresh and undamaged. Finally, he stood back.
"It's completed," he said.
"Bring up the soul," Samson said.
Jennifer Maisel spoke into a fist-sized walkie-talkie, and in a few moments two of her soul-techs appeared, carrying between them the enormous glass tube that contained the living soul of Al North. The light inside the tube no longer flashed and twisted, but clung close to the copper filament, which glowed deep red.
"You think this will actually work?"
"Post-operative re-ensoulment isn't exactly gravitic science," the doctor said. "If you could stuff him for me, Captain."
Jennifer drew Al's body up and hung the head back over the end of the table until his mouth lolled open. She sprayed into it from an aerosol can gaily painted with hieroglyphics in colors familiar to anybody in any of the three parallel worlds, because all three of them had evolved Lysol spray. Then she lifted a thick black cable that was coiled on the floor at the head of the operating table and pushed it deep down Al's disinfected gullet.
"This soul's been cut the way you want it cut, right, General Samson?" the doctor asked.
"I approved your pattern."
"Because, with all these shittily completed new connections, once the soul goes in, the only way you're going to get it out again is by tearing this body to pieces."
"Am I going to want to do that, Maisel?"
"It's been debrided of every thread suggesting independence."
"And the brain?"
Samson asked.
"Its memories have been erased back to 2 days before it entered Cheyenne Mountain," Maisel replied.
One of the Soltecs held the tube, which was about 4 feet across at its top, tapering to a diameter of perhaps 9 inches at its base. Another inserted the cable into the socket.
"How old is that equipment, Maisel?"
"My dad's company buried it in the Egyptian desert at a place called Dendera."
"When?"
8,000 years ago.
"What cheap bastards you people are. What if the humans had found it?"
"Not too likely."
"Still, 8,000 years, and we have to rely on it. That's criminal irresponsibility, in my opinion."
"The objective is to create wealth for garbage like you to enjoy, General, not spend it on extravagant equipment we can do without. And I can't help it if my family has been running a successful enterprise for 20 generations and you're a propertyless consumer."
The body began heaving.
"Don't lose this, Maisel."
She raised her eyebrows.
"Doctor?"
"Normal," he snapped.
"Fill it," she said to her Soltecs.
One of them began raising the impedance in the tube until the soul was a purple spark dancing on the end of the filament. The body heaved again, then again.
"You're sure these seizures aren't a problem?" Maisel asked the doctor.
"You can't expect this to work like modern equipment."
Samson snorted derisively, but made no comment. Slowly, the color of the filament went from purple to violet, then to white. The body's eyes flickered open. The chest gave a great oily heave. The muscles rippled, the skin flushed, and there came from the gaping mouth a noise, ear-splitting, like a hiss of gas escaping a broken pipe. A scream, Samson realized. That had been a scream. And then Maisel said,
"Look."
The tube that had contained the soul was as black as a shroud. Al North's eyes were open, though. Wide open. General North was crying. Chapter 15. December 19th, pre-dawn. The Stalker. They'd made a sort of evil golem. A monster that would be incapable of disobeying its orders, but it was more than that. Wiley saw the idea behind it. They had used the eyes and lips and tongue and the other parts they had managed to cut out of poor John Nunnally from down the road and grafted them into the body of Al North. Because the result was mixed of flesh from the two Earths, they probably hoped that it could move more freely in our world and get around the fact that, because we ignored them, they could not enter freely here. Unlike the Outrider and the Wanderers from the other Earth, it would be able to enter this world fully. So far, the only person who had managed that, seemingly without any restriction, was Trevor. But now there would be another, and this one would come with blood in his eye, a monster in the truest definition of the word. Wiley wanted to stop writing. He wanted to warn his family, but his fingers moved relentlessly on, taking him where they chose to take him, on a journey he could not stop and could not control. He was aware that dawn was coming, but he could not stop. He could not speak. He couldn't even turn away from the keyboard. Nick slept in the easy chair that stood in the corner. Brooke, he thought, was in their bedroom. The problem was that this monster was intended to cross the gateway and come up that hill and come to this house and kill them all. And now they were asleep. And they were not reading, and so they could not see this warning. And as hard as he tried, he could not call out to them, and he knew that time was of the essence. Then he was swept away, far away, to the last place he cared to go, almost as if some larger force was at work, a silent wizard controlling the whole horrible catastrophe. Here, he saw dark, complicated heaps up and down sidewalks, bits and tatters of paper and clothing, and all manner of debris blowing in a north wind, and there was a smell, thick, sweet, that he recognized as the odor of many dead. He was in New York, the New York of the Two Moon Earth, and these were people who had leaped from their apartments up and down Fifth Avenue, and there were more of them. Wiley was sure, on every single street, everywhere in the city. Details struck him. An Armani purse lying open on the sidewalk. A doorman who had shot himself at his post, his brains hardened on the wall behind him, his kind old face crossed by a path of busy ants. A bicycle lying neatly against a lamppost. He moved with a dreamer's gliding ease, but the horrible precision of reality, into a side street. Here was a little restaurant called Henri's, all of its sidewalk tables bare, a full bottle of Clicquot champagne standing on a waiter's station beside a copy of The Times for the day New York got hit, December 6th. Headline, Bizarre Tragedies Shock World. There was a flag snapping before a brownstone, and he could see that it was an art gallery, but he didn't go in, not in this storm-tossed, broken morning. He fought to stop his hands, to pull away from the laptop. He could feel Al North standing, moving, on wobbling legs, coughing, gasping, staggering, see him held up by sleek, creamy Maisel and black, gleaming Samson with their lithe bodies and long claws and their cruel, reptile faces. New York gave way to the ocean. Big, green waves involved with complicated little waves, and off through the bounding whitecaps, the healing, dark shape of a great liner. She wallowed in the storm, and as he drew closer, he saw that her bows were well down, and every time a wave struck her streaming flank, a great spray of water shot up, pushed across her by the driving wind like her own private rainstorm. The people had disappeared from the deck like so much sea foam, but he was not long there. He was inside, in the great sweep of a restaurant, with chairs waltzing to the roll of the ship. But there were also others there, men in tuxedos, women in long dresses standing at the tall windows of what he supposed was the main restaurant. What was so appalling was that they had been made wanderers here, and had simply starved to death. He could see trenches in the carpeting under their feet. They had continued to walk after hitting the wall. He could see their sunken, gray faces.
"I have to get home. Somebody help me."
And then he was on a twisting street. There were pushcarts everywhere, little motorbikes, signs in an unknown language, and dogs barking and monkeys chattering in the blaze of day. But the streets were empty. And not only that, water was coming, and the buildings were heaving like women beneath the plunging weight of the night, and small, intricate waves came farther each time the place shook, the careful water licking the motorbikes and the paper signs and the cold sidewalk bakeries where naan had been sold for a few rupees. India, some great city, and it was dead, and it was sinking. He was alive in it, completely, standing at an intersection. Down the street, a luxury building in the chaos, a Four Seasons hotel with curtains blowing out the windows. He looked down at the sloshing water. How very carefully it licked his bare feet, how clear it was, despite being floated with cigarette ends and Fanta bottles and plastic bags and sodden gray discs of naan from the dead bakery. Then he was in woods, his woods, and he saw a man.
"Nick, Brooke, Kelsey, for the love of heaven, wake up!"
Al North was walking, and his movements were strange, purposeful, but odd. He was flickering as he walked, like he wasn't entirely there. When he blundered into brush, he would mutter and groan, and there would be blue flashes all around him. Where his feet touched grassy places, there was flickering blue fire.
"Mommy, Daddy! Mommy, Daddy!"
Kelsey flew in, throwing her arms around Wiley, who still could not stop typing, and Nick slept on.
"Daddy, Papa Bear is in the woods!"
At last, Nick woke up. He shook his head.
"Hey, baby," he said to his sister. "Daddy's busy." "Look at the book, Nick. Look this way."
Kelsey went into her brother's lap.
"Yeah, Kelsey, it's Papa Bear," Nick said.
He reached over and shook Wiley's shoulder.
"Dad, you want to stop for a second? A little girl wants to say good morning."
"There's a Papa Bear in the woods, Daddy."
With every ounce of strength in him, Wiley tried to react. But his hands swept the keys, and his voice remained as paralyzed as it always was when this seizure-like state was upon him. "Look at what I'm writing, for the love of all that's holy." He tried all caps. "Look at this. Hello, Nick. It's Al North in the woods."
"Why don't we pull out the guns today, Dad?" Nick said, the sleepy calm of his voice revealing that he had not looked.
"Oh, no, Nick. It was just Papa Bear."
"We need the guns to be ready, Kelsey."
"Mommy, Nick is scaring me."
"Nick?"
Brooke came in. She glanced at Wiley. He could feel her looking at the screen. But then Kelsey ran to her, and she was distracted.
"Danger, danger, danger!"
There was a change, he thought, in the way they moved.
"Dad, we're going to go downstairs now."
The three of them left. A moment later, the clattering of the keyboard stopped. He tried to move his hands, and they pulled away. At last, he leaped up and dashed down the stairs.
"Get the guns out," he shouted. "Al North is in our woods."
They were in the family room, the three of them. The gun cabinet was open. The Magnum lay on the coffee table. Kelsey sat on the couch with her thumb in her mouth and her knees pulled up under her chin. She had saved them all, Wiley thought. He went to her.
"What did Papa Bear look like, honey?"
"He'd been eating strawberries."
"And how do you know that?"
"His mouth was all red."
The crude surgery.
"Dad," Nick said, "he was just here. He came right up to the house. I thought he was going to come in, but something either went wrong or he changed his mind or something."
"Because he didn't come in? You're sure?"
"Of course I'm not sure. Maybe he's in the crawl space. Maybe he's in the attic. Maybe he's invisible or something. I have no idea."
"But you didn't hear him come in."
Wiley went to the window. Nick came beside him.
"There," he said after a moment. "I don't see him."
Then he did. A splash of red in the shadowy woods. His crude surgical wounds. Then he saw also a flash of metal. There was a figure back among those trees, most certainly, and in its hand was a very big, very ugly gun.
Chapter 16. December 19th, morning. Soul Hunt.
Martin had circled around away from the clearing where he'd seen the moving shapes of the monstrous spiders the kids called outriders. He'd gone up along the ridgeline that led eventually to his house, but not in that direction, no way. The idea of going anywhere near that misshapen ruin sickened him. It had been raining hard, but now that had stopped and second moon was low on the horizon, casting its glare over the tumble of rocks and twisted little trees that he could see below him. He was trying very hard not to think about the future, of which he obviously had none, and above all, not to feel angry at Trevor. Of course, the son he'd loved, little Trevor, was no more. The strange being who had taken his place knew the world in a whole new way. "But I love you," Martin whispered to the silence. He always would. The little boy, whom he had held tight in the scary nights, who had looked at him with joyous, dependent eyes, who had so admired his dad. No matter how far beyond the edge of the known world Trevor went, Martin would follow in his heart, trying to understand, trying still to give what he could of love and support. Then it hit him again. "He threw me out. He did it." And he asked himself, what could set a son to do such deep evil? He had never believed in the devil myth. He'd seen that the Christian devil was the horned god of the old witch cult of Northern Europe, nothing more than that. And the horned god was the old Roman god of festivals, Pan. In other words, a pagan deity had been made into the enemy of the new god. Similar things had been done throughout the history of religion, the gods of yesterday becoming today's demons. Still, it did seem as if something had tipped the balance against the good of the world, and that was why Trevor had done what he had done, and why his own soul was about to be captured, or more likely to die, and his body to become somebody else's property. Thunder clapped, and the rain came again, and in the lightning Martin saw deer. Then he heard, high above, the cry of a nighthawk. Dawn was coming, but these new clouds were so thick that it was, in effect, still night. He clapped his hands over his ears, then turned and pressed his face against the rock. The cleft he was in wasn't even 2 feet deep and hardly longer than he was tall. Rain splashed against his back, and the wind, now wintry cold, now storm-heavy, came in under his torn windbreaker. He was as miserable, he thought, as it was possible for him to be. And maybe, he thought also, with an upwelling of sorrow, maybe it was, quite simply, time for him to go. Lindy and little Winnie were gone, something that he was beginning to think of as an always. It had been hard to accept, and Trevor's rejection on top of it was rawest agony. But how do you manage to commit suicide when you dare not move a muscle? Perhaps if he tried to force his way back into the tent, the kids would shoot him. But how could he make Trevor participate in such a thing? Another cry came, full of eagerness now, trembling above the rumble of the thunder. Martin shifted and looked out across the clearing. Somewhere out there was the Saunders, and the Saunders might be running high. When it flooded, it was as dangerous as hell, and with this rain it was going to be doing just that. If he dove in, the rocks would knock him senseless before they broke him to pieces. Hard, but better than gnawing his wrists open. In relation to the stream, then, where was he? Directions were guesswork, but if he moved down the long slope of the land and stayed in the folds and meadows rather than crossing the ridges, eventually he had to reach the Saunders, unless, of course, he was taken first. He looked out across the dark land, and it was an alien place. The surface of another planet, it seemed. This little woodland where he had hiked and hunted all his life, where he lived. These same trees, these rocks, this speeding storm, all would continue after he ceased to exist. Beetles, hungry in the grass now, would soon find a feast. He stood up into a sheet of rain, then set off running into the roaring dark. The wind made him stagger and the thunder made him cringe as he plunged along. He would have been blinded because of the rain and the dark, but there was so much lightning that it enabled him to find his way. He heard another sound then that he could not quite make out. It was deeper than thunder, the enormous sound, but with hiss in it, and booming, faint but strong enough to shake the lungs. Lightning flashes revealed a wall of haze. He stopped running because he was going toward it. Then he glimpsed its shape. It was a thick funnel cloud, immense, and probably not more than a few miles away, whipping toward him across the broken prairie. He threw back his head and screamed and laughed at the same time, and saw in the storm a black shape sailing easily, a nighthawk. It seemed to be circling him, and he ran toward a stand of trees to get in where a thing like that couldn't go. "Oh, God, Lindy, I'm so sorry. I am so damn sorry." He should never have taken them to that damned church. He should have followed his own instincts and hidden his whole family in the storm cellar. Another flash revealed shapes around him. It was only the briefest vision, but it made him howl like a frantic dog. He whirled round, but they were behind him, too, and closer there. But also, rising into the sky now like a great wall, was the tornado, a looming pillar of death, with darker objects speeding in its funnel. He saw cars, roofing, trees, bodies like akimbo swimmers. He ran toward the storm, then saw just ahead what appeared in the inky rain to be tall bars, and slung among them a black thickness striped with yellow. A claw of lightning flailed in the clouds, revealing by its silver flicker that he was looking at the raised forelegs of a spider the size of a small horse. Then he was down, his breath gone, his head smashed against the ground so hard the crack of his jaw sounded like a shot, and he saw flaring stars in his stunned eyes. What breath he had left was sucked out of him as the ground shook, and in another flash of lightning he saw the thing that had been menacing him shoot off into the sky like a demon flying, or rather, sucked away by the advancing tornado. Light slipped down from the darkness with the shuddering grace of an aurora. Lying on his back, the rain swarming in his eyes, he nevertheless saw his death coming in the great detail with which legend tells us we see our ends, the way the light quested downward like syrup, dropping quickly, white and alive, and raindrops when they touched it making hurrying patters of smoke. But no peace came. Not with this strange numbness. And then the seeing. The seeing. A great alteration of vision, and he felt a kind of ecstasy in his skin, and saw a forest of tapered furniture legs, and knew that he was seeing out of his own infant eyes, his mother's room, where he had taken his first steps, and it was like flying, this wonderful new state of walking on two legs, and the happiness, oh dear Lord in heaven, childhood is the kingdom, it is the kingdom. And he saw how very valuable this commodity called memory was. All the gold of his life, capable of being tasted, touched, and smelled, feeling just as if it was happening again and always. And he knew that the human being is a device that records perfectly the rustle of every leaf and every sweated passage, the happy flying days and the gray ones. And his last thought was how grand, how incredible, what a miracle, and no wonder it took the old Earth 5 billion years to create us. And then, I am to be boxed, catalogued, and sold like dope to somebody who has lost all happiness, all joy, all decency, and is more hollow inside than death and the zero cold of space. I, my eternal being, is to be sold. Red. Voices. A voice. A voice of gold. An angelic, perfect voice. The red became noise, rushing, slapping, became fire, fire on his hip. Somebody sanding his skin, no worse, cutting. They were cutting, and they were sliding the knife between the muscle and the skin. He was being butchered in the field. Trevor's face, beaded with rain, swimming with tears. Trevor, ancient being, journeyer. Like me. Journeyers together, father and son. The wind screamed, rain and hail struck like bullets, and Trevor screamed, "Dig in, Dad! Dig in!" He clutched the ground. All grew silent. It seemed as if the last possible bit of air was pulled from his lungs. He felt his legs rising, heard the deepest rumble he had ever known, and saw the ground just ahead suffused by electric green light. Whereupon, there was an ear-splitting roar, and a truck crashed down from the sky, its lights as they flashed drilling into the rain. It was huge, an articulated 32-wheel poultry mover. Then chickens were everywhere. The clucking, squawking, crowing clumps of feathers and terror flounced like great fluffy snowballs in the rain. The weight left his back. He turned, and a figure was helping him up. A strong male figure. He could not see the face. "They'll be back any second. They won't stop." Trevor ran off into the dark, and Martin did not stop to think or even try to understand what had just happened. He followed, running with all his might, and he found that he could see in the dark of the storm just by wanting to, and could run like an angel with the wind at his back, and he could go and go, his heart ticking like a slow engine. Trevor stopped, grabbed a couple of chickens, and ran on. Martin did the same. They went into deep and deeper woods. The storm passed, bringing with it First Moon, tiny and bright, and with it stars, but also, to the north and west, another massive tower of clouds. They never seemed to end, the storms, as if the unbalanced universe itself must expend energy at every level until equilibrium once again prevailed. Martin heard drumming, and it was soon clear that they were moving toward the tent. "Trevor, they'll shoot." "No, they won't." He snapped the necks of his chickens and laid them next to the tent wall. Martin did the same, then put them beside the others. At that instant, there was a soul-freezing scream, then another, and another, and another, and a dozen great shadows dove at them. One of them swooped right into Trevor's face. It screamed, its red eyes burned, and it flew around him, wheeling tight, as another made the same maneuver. Then Martin was enclosed in cold skin that reeked like garlic and embalming fluid, and claws came against his chest, slicing his jacket and his shirt and slipping into his skin as a knife does into hot wax. It was fear, they had said, fear that the things used as their beacon. Very well. He would take his fear and put it in a box inside him and close it. The thing glared at him. Its eyes so close he could see the fire inside, its mouth open, the white tongue shuddering as a maggot does in the sun. He found, somehow, Franny Glass's Jesus Prayer, and breathed it again and again, and it took him away from his fear. No matter that he was not a believer, it still bore its power to distract a terrified heart. The thing leaped back, giving him a look out of the side of its eyes that was mixed of regret and rage, and a touch even of humor, that this miserable little man had bested it. Pam held the tent flap for them as they went into the candlelight and the drumming. There was not a lot of light, but Martin could make out Len Ward and Claire James beating the drums. He noticed Harrow Cougar's emblems on the skins. He saw so clearly every detail, the eyes of the others gleaming in the candlelight, and he recognized their youth in their scent, the young, powerful smell of his son, the blooming scent of the girls, and he saw them, really saw them. And he knew that only at a few moments in his life had he ever seen people with this clarity, this love, and the abiding compassion that he felt now. Michael Ryan, the Cougars' star tackle, said, "Hey," and looked up at him with those strange, shadowed eyes they all had. Then Pammy began to clap. Trevor threw his arms around his dad. Except for the drummers, they all clapped. "What's going on?" he asked.
"Dad," Trevor said, "please try to understand."
Tears streamed down his face. Martin embraced him. Then a girl he thought was called Crystal something came over. She had a mirror in one hand and a candle in the other. A face looked back at him. It was dirty, wet, thin, and covered by a days-old growth of beard. It was the face of a street person, a hobo, somebody from the lower depths, a miner in the dark of the earth. The eyes looking back at him gleamed darkly, very darkly, in the yellow candlelight. In fact, they were as black as coals, his eyes, just like those of the kids around him and his son. His soul seemed to fill the air of the tent, to mingle with their souls. And it was like picking up a song you'd known always and singing again. Martin understood now what had been done to him. The same thing that had happened to these kids when the light tried and failed to take him. Something was gone, though. It had certainly taken something. Not his essence. He was still Martin Winters. He felt lighter, though, and far more in touch with the world. Not the world of streets and companies and archaeological digs, however. Rather, this world of the here and now. The rain, the trees, the kids in the tent. He was alive, Martin was, more alive than he had ever been before. They hadn't discarded him, not at all. Rather, they had done to him what natural human societies had always done to their shaman and their priests, their healers. They had made him face death, and so come free. That was the difference. The kids in this tent had not been captured by the light, but rather made free by its failure to capture them. Martin was free, too. Trevor was smiling at him. His son's face was soaked with tears. It had been a near thing out there. It had been real. He might not have made it. "Thank you," he said to them all, and to his son. Trevor came to him and leaned against him, and instantly the exhausted boy was asleep in his father's arms. Martin slept too, and the lives of the kids swept on, racing toward the destiny that awaited them now, in just a matter of hours, that would bring them new life, or extinguish forever these last few sparks of the human soul.